j'ai le grand plaisir de vous accueillir pour cette deuxième partie des conférences prononcées par le professeur Peacock au Collège de France. La première partie, comme vous le savez, c'était à huis clos et je suis ravi que le Collège de France ait pu rouvrir ses portes au public. Donc la première partie qui portait sur la conscience de la musique est disponible en vidéo sur le site du Collège de France. Ces conférences-ci sur les normes et le réalisme le sont aussi. J'ai attendu que le Collège de France ait rouvert au public pour avoir le plaisir d'offrir au professeur Peacock de lui remettre cette médaille du Collège de France, comme il est tradition pour les conférenciers invités à faire un cycle long de conférences.
Thank you so much. I'm very honored and very touched. Thank you so much. Now, recognition matters, especially from serious sources, so thank you very much. Okay, and I hope I can do justice to this wonderful thing. So I'm going to be talking this week and next about the domain of the normative, and I'm going to start off talking about factive norms more generally. A factive norm is a norm for judgment that mentions factive states in a sense that I'll try and make clear. And I'm going to claim that factive norms exist for judgments and that they have these properties. They're capable of explaining various epistemological phenomena. They explain various other norms. They exist for a wide range of subject matters, and that's no accident. There's an explanation of why that's so. I think that they can provide, when properly deployed, for partial reconciliation of internalism and externalism in epistemology. I think they have deep sources in the nature of content, rationality, justification, and truth conditions. And I think the correct account of their nature occupies a kind of objectivist position that's intermediate between what's come to be called reason's fundamentalism in the writings of Tim Scanlon and others in ethics, and anti-objectivist, evaluativist positions such as that of Hartree Field on the other. So those are some of the claims. And I'm going to start off talking about the perceptual case. I want to claim that the following norm applies to perceptual judgments. Judge the FA, judge the A is F, on the basis of your perceptual state only if that state is factive in respect of the content FA. And for the perceptual state to be factive in respect of the content FA, is for its possession of that content to be causally explained in the right kind of way by the fact that FA, that is, by the reference of the sense A, having the property picked out by that concept F. I think there's different conditions for being factive for different kinds of states. This just applies to the perceptual case. And what's displayed there is a factive norm for perceptual judgments. It's a statement of a norm, not a description of the conditions under which people actually make judgments, which are, of course, all over the place. And that displayed norm is a norm concerning a certain type of mental action, judgment. Particular judgments made on particular occasions are commonly mental actions. They're actions doesn't mean you can judge legitimately whatever you like. This isn't a form of voluntarism. Calculation is equally a mental action type, instances of which are done for reasons. That doesn't mean you can calculate any answer you like in performing calculation. Both judgments and calculations are mental actions, actions properly constrained by the norms of judgment and calculation. The term factive is sometimes used in application to perceptual experience in such a way as to require not just an appropriate relation of the reason-giving state to the fact that P, but to require also knowledge that P. I'm concerned here with norms whose conditions of application are available in advance of whether the subject is judged at P. Norms for judging cannot imply the thinker's already judged at P. So we can't, for present purposes, use a notion of a factive state that presupposes that the subject is already accepted at P, as it would on a notion of factive state that requires knowledge that P. I think there's a clear notion of a perception being the fact that P that leaves it open whether the perceiver accepts the P or not. So a subject's factive perceptual state can be as of the cup being on the table, it can be entirely appropriately explained by the cup's being on the table, and be genuinely of that cup being on that table, even though the subject is wondering whether it's a trompe-l'œil or a hologram or produced in some virtual reality display or augmented reality. So on the notion of a factive perceptual state that I'm wheeling onto the stage here, the notion X is in a factive perceptual state with content P differs from the states that are picked out by Tim Williamson's factive mental state operators, as he calls them. Those factive mental state operators, such as perceives that P and remembers that P, entail that their subjects know that P. I think that Williamson is right about the entailments of those operators, and I don't think those operators are ambiguous. The factive status of the factive states that I'm concerned with has to be characterized fundamentally in the perceptual case, in terms of a certain kind of explanation of the state, rather than in terms of knowledge. And the explanations may be different sorts in different kinds of cases, I'll be arguing. So an epistemology that endorses the factive norm for perceptual judgments is a factive state-first epistemology, rather than a knowledge-first epistemology. Nonetheless, it's at many points in the spirit of Williamson's position and shares some of its broad philosophical motivations. The conception of a factive state, a factive perceptual state, as making the world present to the subject and in a way that is an input to epistemology rather than presupposing epistemology is a pivotal part of factive state-first epistemology. An epistemology that emphasizes factive states can be much more discriminating than, doesn't need to endorse some kind of entirely general reliabilism in epistemology. Okay, so the factive norm that I've specified so far gives only a necessary condition for making a perceptual judgment. We need a sufficient condition if a norm is going to be of any help in ratifying the making of a judgment, as opposed to merely saying what you mustn't do. It's plausible, I think, that we can strengthen the only if in the norm to if and only if, once we specify that it's a norm for making judgments that simply endorse the content of a perceptual state without drawing on additional information or misinformation beyond the content of the perceptual state. So the biconditional form would be that if making judgment on the matter at all, judge that FA on the basis of your perceptual state when judging without relying also on ancillary information, if and only if that state is factive in respect to the content FA. And the antecedent there, if making a judgment on the matter at all, that's present because the thinker can't judge all the multiple contents of a perceptual experience in respect to which the perception may be factive. It may be a matter of the thinker's purposes, which of the contents is up for consideration. That, of course, doesn't make the holding of the norm itself a pragmatic matter. A content, even a content built from observational concepts, may be judged on a perceptual basis by testimony, by inference. They also have their norms. I'm concerned here just with a norm for perceptual states, and I'll work with that displayed formulation as a first approximation for the moment. Okay, I now want to consider what seems to be a very neglected topic in this area, norms that are derivative from factive norms. Okay. Let's consider any state involving norm that's of the following displayed form there in the inverted commas. If making a judgment on the matter at all, judge so-and-so on the basis of informational state when and only when it's a state of kind K, just because of that abstract schema for the moment. And the factive norm for perceptual judgments, obviously instance of that general abstract schema. And whenever you've got something of that general abstract form, there will be two derivative attitude involving norms. These derivative norms concern what it's reasonable to judge if one's trying to follow the norm. The propositions about what it's reasonable to judge if one's aiming to fulfill the imperative are derivative from the imperative in this sense. They're principles about what it's reasonable to judge if one's aiming in one's judgments to fulfill the imperative in the state involving imperatival norm. So if the imperative in the factive norm for perceptual judgment is indeed a norm for judgment, there are derivative norms about what it's reasonable to do, in this case to judge or not to judge, if you're aiming to bring about the fulfillment condition of that imperative. What you take to be a way of bringing about the fulfillment condition of the imperative depends on the situation you take yourself to be in. If what you take to be a way of bringing about the fulfillment condition is not in fact so, you may not, in fact, be acting in accordance with the imperative, the norm, even though you're trying to do so. We can apply that simple point in the case of the factive norm for perceptual judgment. And the first derivative attitude involving norm is what I want to call the positive attitude involving norm. Whenever it seems to the thinker she's in a state of kind K, taking into account her phrenomenology, her total background information, it'll be reasonable for her to judge the relevant content if she's aiming to follow the norm. It seems to the thinker that conditions mentioned in the state involving norm are met, so correspondingly it's reasonable for her to judge the content for which the norms are seemingly fulfilled. That, it seems to me, is how friends of factive norms should explain the rationality or reasonability of the beliefs of the subject who's in fact a brain in a vat. It can seem to the invatted subject that the states on which she's basing her judgments are factive perceptual states, when actually they're not. The crucial point is it's entirely consistent to endorse the factive norm for perceptual judgments and to hold that the invatted subject is rational in making the judgments she does. In fact, it's not merely consistent. It's required by endorsement of the factive norm once we recognize that a positive attitude involving norm will always be a consequence of a state involving norm. In a slogan, if you like, on the bottom sentence there, norms mentioning externalist properties of states can respect internalist conditions on rationality. The second derivative norm is what you could call the negative attitude involving norm. It's also a consequence of the state involving norm. Whenever the thinker has evidence she's not in a state of kind K, it'll be reasonable for her not to judge in accordance with the state involving norm, even if in fact her state is one of the relevant kind K. These are the cases of genuine factive states of which the subject has been misled into thinking that they're not factive. So the general conception here then is of reasonability in given circumstances being derivative from factive state involving norms, at least for cases that involve relying on non-belief representational states. And it should be obvious, they're analogues of all of these kinds of cases for moral norms. You are, for example, required by the norms of morality to give the life-saving liquid to someone, other things equal. But if you believe that the liquid in question is a poison, you're morally justified in not giving the liquid to the person. That's the analogue of the negative attitude involving derivative norm for the moral case. The point that a state involving norm will imply a negative attitude involving norm can explain, and I argue, justify a divergence from John McDowell's treatment of various examples. McDowell discusses a person who's told, apparently authoritatively, that in her current circumstances, the light may mislead her as to the colour of a thing. In fact, the circumstances in the case are entirely normal, and to quote John McDowell, her perceptual state in looking at the thing is just like a perceptual state that, outside this context, she would rightly take to warrant her in saying it's green. So her perceptual state in the example is produced in the way it is in all normal good cases. And McDowell then asks the question, should we conclude that the thing's greenness is visually present to her? And he says we should not conclude that the thing's greenness is visually present to her in the relevant sense. That verdict on the case seems to me unintuitive. The thing's greenness really is present in perception to our subject. She's just not in a position to know it's present. I think we need to leave room for perceptual presence without the knowledge of presence. Well, I can imagine John McDowell replying, look, Chris, this isn't what I meant by present to her in the relevant sense. He may say what he meant in was the intended sense that supports an attribution to our subject of knowledge of the thing's greenness. And I certainly agree this subject doesn't know the thing is green. But I suggest that our subject fails to have knowledge of the greenness of the thing, not because the greenness is not present to her, it is, but rather because given what she's been told about her circumstances, it is not reasonable for her to think that it's present to her. This is not a case in which it would be reasonable for her to apply the factive norm in reaching a judgment about the colour of the thing. Although her perceptual state is factive, she can't, given what she's been told, reasonably take it to be so. So she can't attain perceptual knowledge simply by endorsing in judgment the content of a perceptual state. Endorsing the content would in those circumstances be irrational. That's a straightforward application of the negative attitude involving norm that's implied by the factive norm for perceptual judgments. Once we're formulating the factive norm for the perceptual cases of biconditional, there's arguably a legitimate notion under which we can formulate the norm as one concerning what it's correct to judge. The formulation would run this: it's correct to judge that FA on the basis of your perceptual state, when judging without relying also on ancillary information, just in case the state is factive in respect of that content. The correctness for the mental action of judging in these circumstances doesn't imply that judgment is correctly made just in case it's true. It could so happen the content of perceptual judgments is true, even if it's not based on a factive state. Nonetheless, there is a connection between the norms for correctness of the judgment and relation to holding the truth condition, and I'll return to that that later on. I think the factive norm for perceptual judgments can explain two points about perceptual judgment. First of all, the factive norm can provide some kind of explanatory unification of the conditions under which we rationally make or withhold perceptual judgments. As soon as we know that we're in the environment in which light rays are refracted or colored light's a real possibility, we will or should rationally withhold judgments we'd otherwise make on the basis of our perceptual states. What unifies all the cases of withholding is that they're all cases in which it's reasonable to think the perceptual state may not be factive. Second, especially relevant to Susanna Siegel's writings on these matters, the factive norm can also explain why, when perceptual experiences are caused by wishful thinking or by emotion, they do not result in perceptual knowledge. Such experiences are not factive. We can explain why experiences caused by wishful thinking or by emotion do not yield knowledge without saying that these experiences are reached by irrational inference. We don't need to say that experiences are rational or irrational to reach the right verdict on these examples. It's quite sufficient to note that in those cases, the perceptual states are not factive. As a topic for another occasion, I think there are interesting and significant relations between factive status and the predictive coding model of perceptual mechanisms and states. Predictive coding, when it's combined with correction procedures when predictions turn out to be unsuccessful, is a mechanism that tends to spread factive status across perceptual experiences, other things equal. If experiences as of P are not explained by the fact that P, and if there are discoverable situations in which there's such an experience but P doesn't hold, then the perceptual system's correction mechanism will no longer produce an experience as of P in those circumstances. Other things equal, of course, is an important qualification. In the case of adaptive false positives, for example, in having experience of the face or profile of a predator when no predator is present, the perceiver may run away without time to discover there's no predator there. But in the case where correction is possible, available, and not maladaptive, the correction mechanism in predictive coding will tend to make experiences factive. A theory of factive states also has to be integrated into a proper computational theory of perceptual experience. Since time is pressing, I won't go into that. Let me also note, though, that there is a connection between the conception I'm developing here and what's come to be called the relational conception of experience of perception in other factive states. A factive state provides for a thinker a relation to the objects, properties, and relations the perception is of. This relation is fundamental to the normative status of perception in perceptual judgments. The state that's mentioned in the factive norm for perceptual judgments is one with object involving intention or content. The state so mentioned is a perception of an object under a certain mode of presentation, that it has a certain property, also under a given mode of presentation. The state required for judgment in conformity with the factive norm is not one that's common both to genuine perception of the relevant object and to an illusion that there's an object given under the relevant mode of presentation. This isn't disjunctivism under one formulation of that doctrine, since there's no denial here that there's some common element to the genuinely perceptual and illusory cases. But there is a commitment rather to the view that the state mentioned in the factive norm is not one that's common both to genuine perception of the relevant object and to the illusory case. Okay, I hope we've got enough before us there to permit continued use of the notion of a factive state or event, while acknowledging there's lots of further tasks. Now I want to consider a range of generalizations of this conception and then consider more generally the location of the norms that it identifies in the space of possible positions about the nature and source of norms. Okay, here's a first generalization to the case of action. For a perceptual state to be factive in respect to the content P, it has to be causally explained by the fact that P. But I now want to make three further claims. First of all, for states of other kinds, there are corresponding structurally analogous but different conditions for them to be factive. Second, these different conditions are unified at a more general level. For each of the various different subject matters involved in the different cases, these different conditions elucidate what it is for a representational state to have a genuine fact as its content for the subject matter in question. And third, the property of being factive for these other kinds of states features in norms for certain kinds of judgment. Let me start off with the case of action, certain kind of knowledge of action. An apparent action awareness of performing a certain action sometimes shares a cause with that very action. More specifically, there's an event which causally explains both the awareness and the action of which it's an awareness. It's a matter of some discussion in the philosophical and psychological literature how that event should be characterized. Some say it's a trying, but that isn't essential for the existence of a common cause of the awareness of the action and the action itself. It's important that the initiating event has a certain content, that a fying occur, and that its having that content explains the occurrence both of the awareness of fying and the action of fying. When those conditions are met, the awareness is factive in respect to the content, I'm fying now. Such action awareness is well known to be independent of perceptual awareness and proprioception. Action awareness of raising one's arm can be present in one whose arm is anaesthetized and who's raising his arm behind his back or with his eyes closed. And such factive states of action awareness are correspondingly mentioned in a norm for a subject's judgments about her actions. Judge I'm fying now on the basis of your apparent action awareness when judging without relying also on ancillary information, if and only if that state is factive in respect of a content, I'm fying now. And as before, that will generate positive and negative attitude involving norms. The mechanism of predictive coding actually is relevant there for knowledge about one's own actions. Here's a second dimension of generalization. The whole domain of understanding that involves a certain kind of tacit knowledge. Let's start off with some seemings. There are mental states in which something seems to be the case to the subject, seemings, which are neither action awareness nor purely perceptual awareness. They're fundamentally intellectual seemings. And I think some of these seemings can be factive too. Consider first the relatively simple case in which someone has tacit knowledge of a definition they may not be able to articulate, but which influences their classification of objects. So the classic case is definition of the English word chair. A person who understands that word can confidently and in a wide range of cases classify successfully presented object as a chair or as not a chair. It seems to the person the object is a chair. That intellectual seeming can be factive when it's causally explained in the right way by tacit knowledge of the correct definition of chair. In such a good case, there's the right kind of connection between what makes something fall under the predicate chair and the subject's intellectual seeming of the presented object that it is a chair. There's a norm, I think, that to judge that a presented object is a chair on the basis of its seeming to be, only if that seeming is factive. And the seeming is factive only if its content is explained in the right way by the subject's tacit knowledge of the correct definition. And as in the previous cases, the subject may reasonably think his state is factive when it isn't. You could apply the same kind of conception to modal logic. If you believe the kind of principle-based account of understanding of metaphysical necessity that I've offered elsewhere, that's another case in which tacit knowledge consists in appreciation of certain kinds of constraints on something being a genuine possibility. That information is drawn upon in the productions of impressions, seemings of necessity or impossibility. I think that the same kind of apparatus can be used in the explanation of logical knowledge too, but time is pressing and I won't go into that case in more detail. Because the more general philosophical issues about the location of this position in relation to other classic philosophical conundrums is I think, more interesting. So, everything I've said so far, I think, involves implicit commitment to a certain kind of broadly rationalist stance in philosophy. In all these most recent cases, that of tacit knowledge of a definition or modal cases, also the case of logical inference I didn't discuss, but it's obvious how it would go, I think the factive norm is an articulation of a classical rationalist idea that knowledge in these domains and rational judgment is founded in the understanding. It's an articulation of that idea if we grant that understanding in these cases involves tacit knowledge that's appealed to in the various cases. And I think that's something that will be found in various other cases that have plausible rationalist treatments. What's then the relation? What's the relation between the thesis that there are factive norms for judgment and the thesis that rationality is in important respects always an internal matter? Are they in tension? If not, why not? And is there a way of explaining how it can be the case that there are factive norms, consistently with some plausible internalist constraints on what constitutes a justification? Well, I want to approach these questions by way of considering the position of Ralph Wedgwood, who's a leading internalist. Wedgwood endorses a thesis about the internal character of rational belief revision. And here's a quote from him, an article almost 20 years ago now. He writes, "The rationality of a belief revision depends on the basic rules that one was directly following in making that belief revision, and so on the proximate explanations of the belief revisions that one made in following these rules. And the proximate explanation of a belief revision is always an internal fact." That's the end of the quote. So suppose everything in that quotation is true. There's the quotation. The rationality of belief revisions always depends on basic rules one following making the belief revision. Proximate explanation of belief revisions always an internal fact. Suppose that's all correct. It does not follow that the norm one's attempting to follow in making the belief revision mentions only internal states. Consistently with all those propositions in the quote from Wedgwood, the norms one's attempting to follow may not involve beliefs at all, and certainly not only beliefs. Before we turn to some more general theses, let me give some examples. So first, you're attempting to check whether a long arithmetical calculation you've written out is really correct. They are indeed internal states that constitute the proximate explanation of all the changes in belief you go through in the process of checking. But the norm to which you're aiming to conform are the principles, the recursive definitions of addition, multiplication, other algebraic operations. Those norms are neither internal nor mind-dependent. Second, same applies to a detective trying to reconstruct a sequence of events leading to a crime. The detective's beliefs will change as evidence accumulates, and the approximate explanation of her belief changes will always be internal states, changing beliefs, experiences, memories, and so forth. But the norm for correctness of her hypotheses and her aim in making judgments is what really explains the objective traces that she encounters of early events. That is not an internal fact. So in both of these cases, the first two sorts, we cannot make sense of the belief changes, I think, as rational, except insofar as they're governed by these sorts of norms. And I suggest the same applies to rational norms more generally. Even if rationality is internal in the sense that Wedgwood endorses, it by no means follows that the norms the rational thinker is aiming to follow mention only internal states. I don't think this is an accident. It's not just an accident that we can make these points in each of these kinds of examples. These points are available because I think there's a general principle that applies. When a thinker makes a justified rational transition in thought between contents, there's some objective structure of contents such that the thinker is justified in virtue of the thinker's relation to that objective structure. And I call this, I dignify this claim by the name the principle of objectivity for the case of transitions. In the case of deductive inferential transitions, the structure of contents expressed by a proof is the objective structure of contents. For the case of deductive justification, the objective structure in question must be truth-preserving. I think there's an objective structure of contents also in inductive inference and inference the best explanation, if we find it hard to state exactly what the precise conditions are. These points, if correct, mean that justification cannot consist solely in internal and wholly mind-dependent matters. It doesn't follow that there isn't a more modest internalist position that respects the principle of objectivity. The modest internalist position should say that justification involves a certain mental relation to objective structures of contents, and that apparent justification consists in apparent relations to apparent objective structures. So this modest internalist can agree with the quoted passages from Wedgwood, consistently with acknowledging the principle of objectivity. Okay, next step is to say more about principle of objectivity and factive norms. The general principle of objectivity states that we can explain what it is for a thinker to have a justification for a transition or for a belief only by reference, direct or indirect, to some objective structure of contents such that the thinker has that justification in virtue of the thinker's relations to that structure. Justification, according to the principle of objectivity, cannot be explained solely in terms of the thinker's mental states or attitudes entirely independent of content. Nor, for that matter, can it be explained solely as a matter of the thinker's environmental or other external relations entirely independent of content. How does the principle of objectivity apply to judgments that are non-inferential? Well, in that limiting case, the objective condition concerning contents in terms of which justification is to be explained. It's simply that the content be true, since the truth is the aim of judgment. But we need to be much more specific about the objective structure of contents that's important here. An objective justifying structure can be more specifically said to be a decorated inverted tree structure. This notion of a decorated inverted tree is a generalization of a natural deduction structure in logic. In a natural deduction, the final conclusion corresponds to the apex of the tree, and at each node in the tree, other than the initial premises, there's associated a rule by which the sentence of that node is related to and appropriately justified by prior nodes. In the generalization I'm concerned with here, at each node is an intentional content, something at the level of sense. At the apex of the tree is the justified intentional content. The nodes of the tree are not just labeled, but they're decorated. The decoration consists in the fact that for each node, there's either a factive state type, such as perception or action awareness or genuine memory, with that content assigned to that node, or a principle of inference whose conclusion is the intentional content of that node, relating it to premises that are contents elsewhere in the tree. So under this conception, there's various ways in which a thinker's seeming justification for accepting a content can fail to have the right relation to an appropriate decorated inverted tree structure. One kind of case is that in which the thinker's relevant experience is not factive. Another kind of case is that in which a thinker is trying, for example, to apply an inferential principle that's in fact correct, but mistakenly thinks that some particular propositions provide an instance of that principle when they don't. I think that the explanation of why there are factive norms across so many domains is that only factive norms are adequate to explain the nature of justification. And that's so as a consequence, in part, of the principle of objectivity. Though thinkers often fail, what makes even a seeming justification have that status is that it is for the thinker as if she's in a state that's sufficient for the truth of the content judged. Only factive states, whether perceptual, action awareness, or understanding based, can have the status being mentioned in norms whose fulfillment is sufficient for the content judgment being correct. So I think the principle of objectivity, in effect, gives us some kind of transcendental argument for the existence of the factive norm for perceptual judgments by drawing on general abstract considerations of the nature of judgment and its relation to objective structures of content and their relation to truth. But that general argument just outlined, if sound, requires the existence of factive norms for all non-inferential cases, not just the perceptual ones. If sound, the argument explains why it's not just an accident there are factive norms in the various domains I discussed earlier in this talk. Only factive norms, I think, can meet the conditions on the nature of justification required by the principles of objectivity. If we consider the issues from a much greater distance, if we zoom out 30,000 feet above this landscape, I think these arguments for the principle of objectivity and the involvement of content in the account of justification may be compared, with suitable humility, in their abstract structure with Frege's arguments that we can't give a good account of belief states without the use of a notion of content, or thoughts in Frege's conception. Just as Frege argued that we can't account for propositional attitudes using only an ontology of mental subjective events, as conceived in philosophy prior to Frege, nor can we do it using only physical classifications, so a similar claim can be made about the nature of justification by the principle of objectivity. In both the case of attribution of propositional attitudes and the case of justification, the argument shouldn't be taken to force a conception of an inaccessible third realm, but should rather be taken to enforce recognition of a classification of judgments and other mental and linguistic phenomena that's neither purely subjective, as the mental was conceived prior to Frege, nor purely physical either. In both cases, truth evaluable contents play a crucial role in the argument. In both cases, of course, we have to elucidate and integrate metaphysics and epistemology for the contents required by these arguments. Okay, you may think, well, that sounds okay so far for a certain range of cases, but we obviously do have such a thing as non-factive justification in inductive inference and in inference to the best explanation. So it may be asked, why shouldn't this equally be available for the justification of non-inferential judgments? And simply insisting they are non-inferential isn't really an answer. But there are differences between the cases that don't beg any questions. Consider the initial beliefs from which a thinker makes an inductive inference or an inference to the best explanation. They fail to meet Crispin Wright's condition that if what's inferred from them inductively is false, then that can only be because of some defect in the pedigree of those beliefs, An inductive inference, or an inference to the best explanation, may have a false conclusion, even though the premises from which they're reached are fully justified, true, known, entirely non-defective. The means by which the judgment is reached in the perceptual case, when the thinker is operating in accordance with the factive norm, is, however, not independent of the correctness of the content judged. If the perceptual state has to be factive for a good pedigree for a perceptual judgment, then that commitment is not independent of the correctness of the content judged, because factiveness in the basic perceptual cases does require explanation of the very holding of the content judged. That point still allows us to respect the core of Crispin Wright's idea. It suffices to say that when the judgment is based on some prior states is false, the explanation never has to do with features of the causal origin or other defects of those prior states, period. The crucial point in the non-inferential case is that the thinker is not relying on more than the state when it has a proper pedigree. By contrast, the content of supporting beliefs in inductive inference or inference to the best explanation, they could all be true, while the conclusion reached by inductive inference or inference to the best explanation is false. The content of a perceptual judgment could not be true, and the content of the perceptual state on which it rests be false, when the judgment rests on no more than the perception itself. Okay, let me turn, before time really runs out, to the interesting question of the source of factive norms. Amongst norms for judging a given content, we can distinguish between those mentioning states required for grasping the content, for being capable of mental states containing that content, and those which are not so required. Some people have perfect pitch and are capable of recognizing middle C when it's sounded on an instrument. Perhaps it is indeed a norm for those with this recognitional capacity to take factive experiences of middle C as reasons for judging that middle C is being sounded. But that's that kind of sensitivity to that kind of norm, can't be required for possession of the concept of the pitch middle C. Most of us have that without being capable of perceptually recognizing middle C. We can call a norm that mentions states that are required for grasp of the content in question canonical norms for the concept. And I propose this thesis about the source of factive canonical norms. The source of factive canonical norms for a given content is twofold, consisting in one, the thinker's aim of truth, inter alia in judgment, together with two, the fundamental reference rules for the concepts composing the content. And they call that the source thesis. Of course, the way in which the source thesis holds will vary for the kinds of content and mental states in question. Under the source thesis, factive norms matter to us because the aim of truth matters to us. The account explains why these norms are so important to us. They are as important as truth is. The way in which the source thesis holds, if it does, for various different factive canonical norms will be different in detail for the various kinds of factive states I've already identified. Those factive states are multiple different kinds, obviously. Some are conscious states, such as perception, action, awareness. They provide norms for outright judgments. Some are states involving transitions from one judgment to another, and so forth. So the source thesis has to be elaborated and implemented somewhat differently for each of those different kinds of case. But to keep things manageable, or at least manageable by me, I'll focus initially on factive canonical norms for judging perceptual contents. Here, very briefly, is an outline, maybe obvious to real enthusiasts for this subject matter, how this is going to go. Here's an outline of how the fundamental reference rules for concepts, together with an aim of truth in judgment, can generate a canonical factive norm in the perceptual case. Consider a factive perceptual state with the observational content, that tile is square. So that tile is perceptual, demonstrative, perceived tile. You apply the observational concept square. What makes something the property picked out by the concept square is that it's the property objects are perceived as having in genuine perceptions of objects as square. Call that the making condition for predication. What makes something the reference to the perceptive demonstrative of that tile is that it's the tile that's given in a certain way in perception on this particular occasion. So call that the making condition S for subject. The factive status of the perception implies that the object meeting condition S has the property meeting condition P. That is, implies the judgment is true. And I hypothesize that this is why the occurrence of such a factive perception type is a factive canonical norm for the intentional content that tile is square. The fundamental reference rules for the concepts occurring in the content of the judgment are crucial in that explanation. What makes something the reference of the constituent concepts is so closely tied to perceptual relations in the case of observational contents that it's founded in the nature of the fundamental reference rules. For the time being, let's continue to focus on perceptual cases and that style of explanation. This source thesis seems to me to imply the falsity of a generalized fundamentalism about reasons. Fundamentalism about reasons has been much discussed in moral philosophy. It's been given less attention in other areas of philosophy, even though, of course, it's an entirely general doctrine. What exactly does it mean? Well, in his book, Being Realistic About Reasons, Tim Scanlon formulates the doctrine of reasons fundamentalism, and as he states it, it has two components. First component states the irreducibility of reasons to the non-normative, and he rightly distinguishes that from a second independent component that says the following of reasons: nor can they be explained in terms of notions of rationality or rational agency that are not themselves claims about reasons. Nor can they be explained in terms of notions of rationality or rational agency, not themselves claims about reasons. So this second component is a claim about the irreducibility of reasons within the normative domain, whether or not the normative can be reduced to the non-normative. And the source claim, as I've formulated it, certainly in the particular case of perceptions as reasons for judgment, seems to me to be in conflict with this second component of Scanlon's reasons fundamentalism. The fact that it's a constitutive aim of judgment, that it aims at least at truth, is not a claim about reasons. Attribution of a truth condition to a content based on fundamental reference rule is also not a claim about reasons. These are both constitutive claims. But those are the two principles on which the source claim relies. My position then on factive norms and their source is intermediate between two more extreme poles. At one pole, there's the position that reasons are not explicable in terms of rationality, something that Scanlon endorses. Reasons for judgments in particular are also taken as fundamental in Bob Brandom's account of meaning and content. So his position is also at this first pole. Reasons as irreducible, not to be explained in terms of something else. At the other pole is a kind of anti-realism about the normative in the areas of meaning and content, a kind of expressivism about the norms associated with them that's been endorsed in several papers by Hartree Field. Field's view is that the normative in the epistemic realm simply arises out of our normative policies. There's no normativity other than what supervenes on our normative policies under this evaluativist view. So the middle position that I'm trying to occupy could be labeled reasons dependent, because I think the status of these norms does depend fundamentally on relation to truth conditions. Reasons dependence with objectivism about reason. It's not an evaluativist, non-factualist view like Hartree Field's view. Let me make a few comments on these more extreme positions, taking first Hartree Field's evaluativism. Field's evaluativism stands in very stark contrast to the objectivity implied by the view for which I've been arguing. According to the source thesis, the canonical factive norms for judging a content are fixed, given its conceptual content and the aim of truth. On the present account, there's no further degree of freedom that allows variation in whether a thinker is constrained by the canonical factive norm once it's fixed which concept she's employing. In employing certain concepts and in aiming to judge only the true contents, it's already determined that the corresponding norms apply to the thinker's judgments. Rationality requires the thinker to judge in accordance with them. And I maintain that, of course, not just for perceptual case, for logical case, for all these other cases. I think evaluativism faces many, many challenges. Does it give a plausible account of the rationality of epistemic evaluations? Are epistemic evaluations answerable to constraints? What's their source? But I won't pursue that now. I think often what's really driving here and elsewhere somebody to a non-objectivist theory is skepticism about the alternatives. The alternatives are all terrible, so you better be an evaluativist. That's certainly something that motivates Hartree Field. If you look at his articles on these topics, what he's really skeptical about is the idea you give any objectivist account of the norms here. So let's look at those sources of skepticism about the alternatives. A first source of skepticism that's emphasized by Field is that the natural resource for normative realism about epistemic norms is some notion of reliability, and that's obviously inadequate from the basis of all kinds of examples in epistemology. And I think the theorist of factive norms should agree that pure reliabilist accounts are no good. We've already noticed how factive norms for perception slice much more finely than reliability and the perception of shape. Applies across lots of other cases too. Field himself mentions the example of entirely reliable transitions from any premise, for example, to Fermat's last theorem. That's not a justified or reasonable transition for anyone who doesn't know the proof of Fermat's last theorem. But the transition is also not in accord with any plausible development of the factive norm's view. A plausible development will formulate a canonical factive norm based on a suitable sensitivity to the fulfillment of the conditions for understanding the expressions involved in the transition, or equivalently, the conditions for grasping the concepts involved. And the conditions for grasping the elementary arithmetical concepts and quantifiers used in the formulation of Fermi's last theorem do not at all require that the thinker have any kind of appreciation, however tacit, that Fermi's last theorem holds. The factive norms I've appealed to in the positive account outlined so far involve subjective states in the sense that there's something it's like for a subject who's in such a state. That applied in the perception case and other cases, and it applies even in the intellectual seeming cases. These factive states are Janus-faced in respect of their relations, both to the internal and to the external or the objective beyond the internal world of the thinker. Since the factive states are subjective states, norms mentioning them respect the idea that norms must mention something that's accessible to the thinker. Such factive norms are not vulnerable to the classical and correct objections to pure reliabilism. Factive norms of the sort I've been discussing don't involve any kind of pure reliabilist theory of justification. But in being factive, they still involve the thinker's relation to the facts themselves. I think they're well suited to meet both the external demands and the internal accessibility requirements that are properly placed upon epistemic norms. Let me also emphasize, it's probably obvious anyway, objectivism about factive norms doesn't involve any kind of foundationalism. I've characterized factive states in such a way that a thinker can be wrong about whether she's in a factive state or not. And the assessment of a state as justifying an observational judgment is something that's revisable, certainly need not be a matter of certainty. Holism of the evidence is entirely compatible with the existence of factive norms. A factive norm is not itself holistic, mentioned as just a particular kind of mental state, but the question of whether it's fulfilled in a given case may be a case in which the holism of the evidence is highly salient. So as far as I can tell, recognition of the existence of factive norms is consistent with the application of Neurath's image of the sailors repairing the ship as they continue to sail in it. Whether a norm is applicable in a given case, or even whether one's correctly formulated the norm, may involve extensive theoretical observational considerations. Those opposed to objectivism about epistemic norms sometimes, and perhaps understandably given the past literature, describe it as committed to some kind of justificatory fluid that flows along epistemic pipes, transmitting justification as it flows along. Hutcherfield has various entertaining passages in this spirit, in this vein. The position is sometimes caricatured as one which the juice starts with perceptual judgments, flows to transmit justification when it moves along the pipes articulated by the normative realist. If that picture is meant to be incompatible with holism about evidence, I've already said the believer in norms involving factive states should be rejecting it. But I do agree that the picture in Field's caricature is correct when understood as a constraint on a fundamental kind of justification. Elements of the picture are actually required by the principle of objectivity. Having the right relation to a truth conditional content and the preservation of truth under justified transitions are indeed essential components of a certain kind of justification if we're recognizing a substantial notion of truth conditions at all. Holism of the evidence is often just evidence that these conditions for justification are actually met. Let me turn briefly to the other extreme, the reason fundamentalism that you get in Scanlon and by implication in Brandom. Scanlon, to his credit, as a reasons fundamentalist, does formulate a version of a rationality-based account of reasons, and he argues against it. So, does what he says about rationality-based accounts of reasons tell also against this intermediate kind of reasons dependence that I've been arguing for? Scanlon formulates a rationality-based view of reasons as on the screen there. The fact that P is a reason for a person to do A, when and because rationality requires the person to count this fact in favor of doing it. The fact that P is a reason for a person to do A, when and because rationality requires such a person to count this fact in favor of doing A. And I accept that formulation for certain kinds of reasons for judging. When you look at Scanlon's discussion of the rationality-based position, it takes a puzzling turn in the first lecture of Being Realistic About Reasons. Displayed formulation of the rationality-based view is quite general. It's not restricted to reasons for moral action or to reasons for making moral judgments. And as an account of reasons, it applies equally to reasons for judgments about non-moral subject matters. But in his critical discussion of the target formulation, Scanlon actually considers only the categorical imperative of moral philosophy It's implausible to suggest that's relevant to the non-moral cases. But still we can ask, does what Scanlon says against the rationality-based view apply also to reasons for judgment of a content? At the end of his critical discussion of rationality-based views of reasons, Scanlon writes, "It is the point of view of internal reasoning that's primary in an investigation of reasons and normativity. From this point of view, the question of how reasons get a grip on one properly disappears. There's only the question, what reasons do I have?" Let's read this again. It's the point of view of internal reasoning that's primary in investigation of reasons and normativity. From this point of view, the question of how reasons get a grip on one properly disappears. There's only the question, what reasons do I have? And that's how his discussion ends, and that's supposed to be his refutation of rationality-based accounts. And I don't dispute what he says in that quote, that there's only the question, what reasons do I have? But I don't see how that's an objection to rationality-based accounts of reasons. For that account is an account of what makes something a reason for a person. Even if a thinker has only to ask about what reasons she has in making up her mind on an issue, that's entirely consistent with the status of something as a reason being explicable in terms of rationality, in particular in terms of its aiming at the truth in the case of rational judgment. I think it's actually no accident that reason's fundamentalism has problems in explaining the relation between reasons on the one hand and reference and truth on the other. And let me just very briefly consider this issue in relation to positions of Brandom and Scanlon, and then stop. In the case of Bob Brandom, the content of the judgment for which a perceptual experience provides reasons refers to objects and properties. And Brandom has a theory of reference and objects under which these notions, the very notion of reference, indeed the very notion of object, is derivative from reason structures and conceptual role more generally. But perception itself is about objects and properties themselves, in that genuine perception presents certain objects and events as having certain properties and standing in certain relations. Brandom's account of reference in language and in conceptual intentional contents does not explain these object and property involving characteristics of perception. And it seems obvious that the referential features of observational judgments derive in one way or another from their relations to perception and its objects and the properties it presents. Once we respect these connections, it seems we can explain why an experience is a reason for making a judgment, given truth as name of judgment. Obviously, Bob Brandom's global position needs to be engaged at many other points than this, but I do suggest that these considerations about the role of referential relations in determining observational contents constitute just the first of many points at which the supporter of substantive truth-conditional theories of content should be engaging with the Brandomian position. There'll be many other points of engagement too. In the case of Scanlon, it's possible he would agree with Brandom's general account of intentional contents and its individuation in terms of reasons that are alleged not to be further philosophically explicable. Actually, Scanlon does give a general treatment of metaphysics and the level of reference in the second chapter of that book, one chapter called Metaphysical Questions. That lecture itself merits separate extended discussion, but let me just outline my position in relation to what he says there. For the issues about reasons and the level of reference seem to be inextricable from one another. Scanlon's position is in certain respects, has certain affinities, he quite rightly notes, with Carnap's position in empiricism, semantics, and ontology. Scanlon writes, this is an overall summary of his view, "The way of thinking about these matters that makes most sense holds that statements within all of these domains, mathematics, morality and the rest, set theory, are capable of truth and falsity, and that the truth values of statements about one domain, insofar as they do not conflict with statements about some other domain, are properly settled by the standards of the domain that they're about," in some certain sense, internal question. He also says the important and interesting metaphysical or ontological questions are domain-specific. But it seems to me that there's a cross-domain issue here. For each domain, there will be a relation in which a thinker must stand to an entity of that domain in order to be thinking of it in a certain way, under a certain sense or concept. That itself is not a thesis of the domain in the sense that Scanlon talks about this. It's not part of first or second order arithmetic. What are the relations in which a thinker has to stand to something to be thinking of it as the number zero, or to be thinking of an operation as the plus operation? And the same for every other domain. It's not something within the theory of that domain, what relations a thinker has to stand in or to be thinking of things in that domain in a certain way. It's always additional. And Once you've got that additional resource, it may generate all kinds of norms. And I think it does. If the norms come from the fundamental reference rules, there's some kind of grasp of those fundamental reference rules in being able to think about Elms of the domain, you've then got a possible source of norms. It's for any domain, it's always a challenge to say exactly what the relation a thinker must stand in to be thinking of things in that domain in a certain way. But I think once you've properly explicated it, it's a resource that will relate the normative truth conditions and understanding. Let me turn just very briefly once again to the principle of objectivity. I think looming over and structuring all of these issues is the principle of objectivity. For the case of a single content, where we're not concerned with transitions between contents, the principle of objectivity states that what makes something justification for judging the content must involve a suitable relation to the holding of its truth condition, something at the level of reference. And for transitions between contents, the principle of objectivity states the justification must have a suitable relation to the abstract structure of truth-preserving contents, where again, truth preservation is a condition involving the level of reference. For accounts of intentional content in terms of primitive reasons, of a sort conforming to reason's fundamentalism, there couldn't be a substantial or philosophically constraining principle of objectivity. It makes no sense. Reference and truth on such views as Brandom's are explained in terms of complex properties of reasons. Any constraint that good transitions be truth-preserving or that justifications for contents be properly related to truth conditions can, under reason's fundamentalism, be at most a redescription of certain features of transitions captured in reasons for relations or in conceptual content more generally. But if we don't accept pure conceptual accounts of content, the principle of objectivity provides a demanding constraint on good accounts of norms for judgment and theories of justification. And the above account of factive norms in the case of perceptual judgments attempts to respect those constraints. There's a lot to be said about the position that I'm ending up in here. Let me just make one comment and then review what I've said. The comment is this. That a norm exists concerning judgments of certain kinds of contents is not a matter of any thinker's thinking that that norm exists. Once the content is determined, the level of sense and the relations the thinker has to have in order to be thinking of objects and properties in that way, the norms are thereby determined. Thinkers can work out what those norms are, they can be sensitive and so forth, but the existence of the norms is grounded in the nature of content and the aim of truth judgment, according to me. There are many, many other topics of inquiry that branch out at this point. The question of integrating this with a proper empirical psychology, the question of integrating the nature of factive status with computational theories of the mind, how you get into the states that provide the right kind of environmental involving norms for judging contents, all of those are really, really good questions. What I want to suggest is that there's a way of looking at this subject matter that takes the notion of a factive norm as crucial in the area, that grounds the notion of a factive norm in terms of grasp of content, and allows us to integrate, dovetail with one another, internal and external aspects of reasons and justification. Thank you, I'll stop there.